made or made gaseous, they had done it, and in the process produced a body of universal laws so weighty and majestic that we still tend to write them out in capitals. The electromagnetic field theory of light, Richter's law of reciprocal proportions, Charles's law of gases, the law of combining volumes, the Zeroth law, the valence concept, the laws of mass actions, and others beyond counting. The whole world clanged and chuffed with the machinery and instruments that their ingenuity had produced. Many wise people believed that there was nothing much left for science to do. In 1875, when a young German in Kiel named Max Planck was deciding whether to devote his life to mathematics or to physics, he was urged most heartily not to choose physics because the breakthroughs had all been made there. The coming century, he was assured, would be one of consolidation and refinement, not revolution. Planck didn't listen. He studied theoretical physics and threw himself body and soul into work on entropy, a process at the heart of thermodynamics, which seemed to hold much promise for an ambitious young man. Specifically, it is a measure of randomness or disorder in a system. Darrell Ebbing, in the textbook General Chemistry, very usefully suggests thinking of a deck of cards, a new pack, fresh out of the box, arranged by suit and in sequence from ace to king, can be said to be in its ordered state. Shuffle the cards and you put them in a disordered state. Entropy is a way of measuring just how disordered that state is and of determining the likelihood of particular outcomes from further shuffles. Of course, if you wish to have any observations published in a respectable journal, you will need also to understand additional concepts, such as thermal non-uniformities, lattice distances, and stoichiometric relationships. But that's the general idea. In 1891, Planck produced his results and learned to his dismay that the important work on entropy had, in fact, been done already, in this instance by a retiring scholar at Yale University named J. Willard Gibbs. Gibbs is perhaps the most brilliant person that most people have never heard of. Modest to the point of near invisibility, he passed virtually the whole of his life, apart from 3 years spent studying in Europe, within a three-block area bounded by his house and the Yale campus in New Haven, Connecticut. For his first 10 years at Yale, he didn't even bother to draw a salary. He had independent means. From 1871, when he joined the university as a professor, to his death in 1903, his courses attracted an average of slightly over one student a semester. His written work was difficult to follow and employed a private form of notation that many found incomprehensible. But buried among his arcane formulations were insights of the loftiest brilliance. In 1875-78, Gibbs produced a series of papers collectively titled On the Equilibrium of Heterogeneous Substances that dazzlingly elucidated the thermodynamic principles of, well, nearly everything. Gases, mixtures, surfaces, solids, phase changes, chemical reactions, electrochemical cells, sedimentation, and osmosis, to quote William H. Cropper. In essence, what Gibbs did was show that thermodynamics didn't apply simply to heat and energy at the sort of large and noisy scale of the steam engine, but was also present and influential at the atomic level of chemical reactions. Gibbs's equilibrium has been called the Principia of Thermodynamics. But for reasons that defy speculation, Gibbs chose to publish these landmark observations in the Transactions of the Connecticut Academy of Arts and Sciences, a journal that managed to be obscure even in Connecticut, which is why Planck did not hear of him until too late. Undaunted, well, perhaps mildly daunted, Planck turned to other matters. Planck was often unlucky in life. His beloved first wife died early in 1909, and the younger of his two sons was killed in the First World War. He also had twin daughters whom he adored. One died giving birth. The surviving twin went to look after the baby and fell in love with her sister's husband. They married, and 2 years later she died in childbirth. In 1944, when Planck was 85, an Allied bomb fell on his house and he lost everything. Papers, diaries, a lifetime of accumulations. The following year, his surviving son was caught in a conspiracy to assassinate Hitler and executed. We shall turn to these other matters ourselves in a moment, but first we must make a slight but relevant detour to Cleveland, Ohio, and an institution then known as the Case School of Applied Science. There, in the 1880s, a physicist of early middle years named Albert Michelson, assisted by his friend, the chemist Edward Morley, embarked on a series of experiments that produced curious and disturbing results that would have great ramifications for much of what followed. What Michelson and Morley did, without actually intending to, was undermine a long-standing belief in something called the luminiferous ether, a stable, invisible, weightless, frictionless, and unfortunately wholly imaginary medium that was thought to permeate the universe. Conceived by Descartes, embraced by Newton, and venerated by nearly everyone ever since, the ether held a position of absolute centrality in 19th century physics as a way of explaining how light traveled across the emptiness of space. It was especially needed in the 1800s because light and electromagnetism were now seen as waves, which is to say, types of vibrations. Vibrations must occur in something, hence the need for and lasting devotion to an ether. As late as 1909, the great British physicist J.J. Thomson was insisting, the ether is not a fantastic creation of the speculative philosopher. It is as essential to us as the air we breathe. This more than 4 years after it was pretty incontestably established that it didn't exist. People, in short, were really attached to the ether. If you needed to illustrate the idea of 19th century America as a land of opportunity, you could hardly improve on the life of Albert Michelson. Born in 1852 on the German-Polish border to a family of poor Jewish merchants, he came to the United States with his family as an infant and grew up in a mining camp in California's Gold Rush country, where his father ran a dry goods business. Too poor to pay for college, he traveled to Washington, D.C. and took to loitering by the front door of the White House so that he could fall in beside President Ulysses S. Grant when the president emerged for his daily constitutional. It was clearly a more innocent age. In the course of these walks, Michelson so ingratiated himself to the president that Grant agreed to secure for him a free place at the U.S. Naval Academy. It was there that Michelson learned his physics. 2 years later, by now a professor at the Case School in Cleveland, Michelson became interested in trying to measure something called the ether drift, a kind of headwind produced by moving objects as they plowed through space. One of the predictions of Newtonian physics was that the speed of light as it pushed through the ether should vary with respect to an observer, depending on whether the observer was moving toward the source of light or away from it.